Yes, and we're back from Iceland, so I can say for real this time, hello and welcome to episode 89 of the F1 Show for coverage of the Spanish Grand Prix from somewhere in Spain, Barcelona area-ish.
And also a bit of conversation about the Turkish Grand Prix as well.
Right. I'm Robin Warner.
And I am Jim Lau. And first of all, congratulations, Robin. We were in Iceland to celebrate your wedding, and
yes.
It was brilliant.
Quite. Stressful and brilliant.
Yes. So, I mean,
brilliantly stressful.
A lot has happened since we started the F1 Show, as we talked about over 4 years ago. And I got married last year, and you got married this year, and we're becoming cranky old men, I guess.
Very much so. You know, being old kind of sucks, but the cranky part has its moments. It's actually kind of fun.
I was actually been looking forward to this for a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I plan on becoming more crotchety as time goes by.
Oh. Both of us together.
This podcast can only keep getting better.
These kids, they're on my lawn. Crazy kids.
All right, so as I actually tweeted, and some of our followers may have seen this, I ended up watching the Turkish Grand Prix. I was in Iceland already, so I was in a bar in downtown Reykjavik, and the coverage, all the commentary, was in Icelandic.
Which had to be exciting.
Which is not a language that I speak nor understand, except like occasional driver names that got mixed in there.
Yeah, they just use their mouths differently. They have muscles worked that we don't have worked. And it's not always great.
Yeah, so it was a little bit chaotic. Well, I mean, obviously it was a chaotic race. Lots of passes, lots of interesting moves. And I think, you know, one of these sort of, I don't want to say what we've come to expect, but sort of, you know, everyone figuring out, you know, KERS and DRS and everything going. And
between KERS, DERS, and tires.
TERS, as it were.
Look at you coining yet another phrase. Only first couple minutes into the show, no less. Yeah, but between those things, and especially a fun track like Turkey, you know, it was an exciting race, absolutely. And it was all the more exciting for me because I was having a race of my own of finishing the race and needing to actually leave for the airport for me to go to get to Iceland, because you actually left a couple of days before I did, ironically enough. So literally the moment I was done with the race, television was off and we were packing the car to go. So I actually was kind of under the gun. So it was even more exciting for me.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think I did rewatch the race in English, where it made slightly more sense, although still it was pretty chaotic. I mean, there were, I think, was 3 and 4 and maybe 5-stop strategies going on. Pirelli has actually come back and said, all right, that was a bit ridiculous. We're going to try to tone the tires back
right.
A little bit toward maybe 2 and 3-stop strategies. And it's funny thinking back, you know, previous years when, like, a 1-stop strategy was, like, actually an option.
And, oh, it common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of funny how far we've come already.
Yeah. I would have to say the most striking thing, I mean, so first of all, you know, Vettel on pole.
Yeah.
Vettel to win the race.
That just pretty clear. Another dominant performance from Vettel.
I've never seen anyone work so hard for 6th place in my life. Jenson Button passed 50 people.
Somehow.
And he ended up in 6th place. And it's like he didn't move anywhere, but he was passing people all the time. And it was interesting because Button went for a 3-stop strategy, which seems like plenty of stops, right? But it was...
That sounds like a lot.
He ran out of tire. And so he just... He ended up not doing all that well, although his on-track performance seemed quite good. He was fun to watch. I was rooting him on. I'm like, yeah, this is a Jenson Button I want to see. This is great. And then you see the results. I'm like, ah, oh, God, everyone's ahead of him again.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it was tricky. Although I think one of the other stories was actually Ferrari starting to show some pace again with Alonso. And for a while, Alonso read, you know, in a podium spot. But I think one of the more interesting passes of the race, and there were many passes, a lot of them, you know, KERS, DERS, and TERS assisted.
Ah, TERS.
But that's we're going to make that work, I think.
It's going to stick.
But was Mark Webber versus Alonso, where it was like kind of a multi-corner setup. It was, you know, I think the DRS helping them to get close, but then the actual passing, which just came down to driver v driver and who can make the tires stick and, you know, make the car get around these corners and be smart about it. Because, you know, to everyone's credit, really, we've had little incidents and little bumps, and especially like Michael Schumacher at this race, and
yeah.
There's a couple moves. and you know, various little incidents, but actually still no safety cars, even up through Spain as well. So it's been remarkably clean. Like, we haven't had these big any sort of big pileups at the start or any of those.
Right,
I mean, usually,
right,
like turn two or three with all the cars, usually there's like some wing damage or whatever, and it's actually been remarkably clean for as many variables as have changed. But anyway, so this pass, you know, for Weber getting to second spot over Fernando Alonso was just one of those sort of classic moves that really, you know, you could see the setup of it, you could see everything going, and he made the pass and made it work. So it was very cool. But other than that, being that we've had another race in between and a whole trip with Iceland and everything, and there was a lot to cover. There's sort of not a whole lot of other details we can really shed light on from that race.
But I think, you know, the coverage on Facebook was awesome as always, and you know, it seemed like a lot of you guys got to see it and enjoy it, and when we did as well, although in a more chaotic way. But now life is starting to return back to normal a little bit for us, which doesn't necessarily mean relaxed, but it is. You know, there's not some huge special trip that we're worrying about. So
you and I actually sat down in front of the same television in the same room to watch a race together. Yeah.
It was weird. And, so Spain, I have to say, not as exciting as Turkey.
Yeah, there's been a lot of sort of pre-coverage and build-up toward, you know, Spain is going to be the acid test. If they're going to be passing here, then Kurs, Durs, and Turs have all worked. And see, so yeah, I keep using it. I think it'll just become normal soon.
Gotta light them turrs.
That's right. And so they brought it, and so, you know, Pirelli brought the hard tire. It's the first time we've seen it this season.
A brand new hard tire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've used first time, I guess, ever, because we was in Pirelli's last season and all that.
Yes.
So it's a whole new tire, and it's funny because you and I on the show have always talked about how, you know, the tire differential wasn't big enough.
Right.
And finally we're getting what we asked for, and that the hard tire is a hard tire, and
yes,
it lasts longer, and
right,
it's a difference in performance, 2 seconds per lap. And the drivers are like, oh, this is terrible, there's no grip.
Well, what I love is the shock that the announcers have. Is like, it's 2 seconds a lap slower, but it's lasting longer. That's weird. It's like, not at all. Like,
he's not going as fast, and the tire lasts longer, and there's not as much grip. Those things all actually make perfect sense.
Perfect sense.
And the whole point of the rules is, you know, that everyone has to use it, so everyone has that same, you know, penalty and a strategy as to how they make that work. So that's exactly what we wanted.
Right.
And
right,
I don't know how much of an effect that had on... you know, obviously there's some midfield positions and definitely some things that change, but I think overall, I don't think that the, you know, use of the hard tire really changed anyone's day. I mean, I think Jenson Button had good advantage because he was on a three stopper again, right?
Yes.
And was able to, you know, make him last and do pretty well. But it's sort of like the first half of the race was everyone kind of, you know, doing what, in terms of tire changes, what used to be like a normal race worth of, you know, two softs and a hard. And then everyone kind of realized, like, oh, we've got another half of the race to run.
Right.
And then sort of had to do it onto a second set of hards, which is the first time we've seen that. It was kind of
absolutely
interesting how it panned out.
And what struck me was, first of all, it was a very interesting race because it had different phases. For sure, because at the beginning, that start by Alonso was insane.
Yeah, the start was brilliant. I want to...
Absolutely. So he had a brilliant start, and he held on to it through the entire first stint. And even after the first round of pit stops, he was very, very strong. And it looked like Alonso was at least looking for a podium finish. And then the second half of the race kind of settled down. And all of a sudden, we're seeing Alonso and Weber fighting for fourth and fifth. Nowhere near the podium. Not anywhere. So it almost seems like tire strategy is extremely important, not just in the sense of when am I pitting and stuff, but even really having to think through, like, how hard are you going to fight? Because the only thing I can come up with is that Weber and Alonso were pushing each other really hard for a big chunk of the first half of the race and just used up more tires, and that slowed them down. And by the time everything cycled through, that it cost them.
Yeah, and I think right at the start, we kind of agreed that it looked like the Red Bulls were sort of so focused on each other, and there was all this back and forth and kind of angling and almost driving a guy off the road and then not quite, that Alonso, who just also happened to get a really good launch off the line, just kind of drove around him. You know, they were so busy focusing on defending from each other, and then it ended up so Weber, who was on pole, I don't know if we even mentioned that, but it's his first pole position, not by Sebastian Vettel this year.
And by a couple of tenths.
Yeah. And it looked, I think, partly due to Vettel not having Kurz in qualifying, although he says, oh, that wasn't the reason I didn't have pole, but I think he was kind of being diplomatic there.
Right.
So it was, you know.
But, I mean, just to hit that point since we mentioned it, 0.2 is a lot. And I think even if Vettel had full working Kurz, it would have been close.
Yeah.
You know, because I think the best you can get out of Kurz is, 0.3.
I mean, it's not like Vettel came eighth or anything.
So, right, yeah. Exactly.
So, you know, it was a great, you know, great for Weber to get on pole and kind of, you know, at least start to see his luck turn around, or at least it seems so after qualifying. And then, you know, Vettel just being so, you know, just wanting to get past him so much in the first corner, and Weber kind of just, you know, wanting to defend that position and all that, that Alonso just took advantage and just got the inside line, and then Vettel actually got around Weber as well. So Weber went from first to third in the first, you know, quarter of a mile. It was a sort of disappointing start for him. And Button also just didn't get away well. He said it felt okay, but then everyone started just driving past him.
Again, I'm putting my Button fan hat on. I have many hats. And this one's tall.
Yeah.
And lovely. Anyway, it's on. And I was so impressed with Button. I was really happy to see him put in a nice, strong qualifying performance compared to Hamilton. They were just 0.03 off of each other, third and fourth. I'm like, this is great. And then, boom, Alonso slots in between them. I'm like, the one time Button's actually really close to Hamilton's time, and then he loses. It's oftentimes we've seen a couple of tenths gap between the two, but they're still next to each other. Then Button, by the time he was at turn 10 or something like that, he was 10th.
It was bad.
So he went from 5th to 10th on the first lap, and really the first few corners. And so that was tough to see. But then, you know, he again, like you mentioned earlier, he was on a three-stop strategy. And a lot of people ended up doing four stops again, and he did very well with it this time and ended up on the podium.
Yeah, I think the strategy just kind of happened to work for him this weekend. So qualifying was actually a little bit weird. I mean, Q1 was sort of the standard deal, and the game in Q1 was basically, can I get a fast enough lap time without using any of my soft tires, you know, without using any of the option tires?
Or as few as possible,
at least. Yeah, and all the top guys pretty much did. But then, you know, there were some stragglers as far as, you know, not wanting to use tires and sort of for the bottom teams. I mean, that's all they can hope for is just the best spot they can get in Q1. So they're on their soft tires. But so Q1 was, you know, the usual sort of frantic action with everyone. And then Q2 settled down quite a bit. And so, you know, the session started and there was several minutes before anyone went out on track.
Absolutely.
And then the Red Bulls went out and set some times and whatever. But then Q3, which, you know, normally, you know, it's only 10 minutes and everyone's kind of got their sessions. And what we've seen, certainly at the end of last year and most of the beginning of this year, was sort of two phases of it, right? Everyone goes out and does their first phase. They see what they can get. They come back in, get fresh tires, and then set the actual pole time. And every once in a while, the faster time is in the earlier phase.
Yep.
But this time was really just a little bit strange in that it was, I think the Red Bull is pretty much the first to go out and actually set in lap times. And those were it. I mean, it was Weber's on top and Vettel's right behind it. And then everyone else, through trying to conserve tires and realizing that they, you know, no matter how hard they pushed, they couldn't get to that pace. So it's no sense in wasting the tires. Then it was like quiet for minutes.
Right.
And then at the end, then everyone kind of went out and did their laps, and that's why, you know, so the McLarens were next, and then it was you know, Lewis's and Jensen's lap.
And Schumacher didn't go out at all in Q3. He made it to Q3, and then he didn't budge. He said, we're done. We're not wasting the tires. And it's actually quite interesting because it goes to two points. One, tire, you know, managing tires is becoming extremely important, which isn't an all bad thing. I hope that qualifying doesn't become too unimportant. Like, you know, I still want qualifying to mean something, and I think the drivers still do, but it certainly isn't as important as it was previously. But the second thing is there's been a lot of complaints. An interesting phenomenon of that, the Pirelli tires don't tend to rubber in the track as much as the Bridgestones do, but they tend to instead build up more marbles. One thing that was pretty impressive with the Bridgestone tire was that it didn't have many marbles, and the track always, pretty much in every situation, tended to get quicker and quicker and quicker as rubber got embedded into the asphalt.
And
that doesn't seem to happen. It hasn't seemed to happen so much this year. So that has two effects, right? One, going out in the last possible moment of the qualifying session doesn't have the advantage that it did in the past. And two, you don't want to waste the tires in the first place. So it's been interesting to see that. People, you know, the teams realize that and you know, adjust their strategies accordingly.
Yeah, it's cool. It kind of makes me want to, you know, see not a new tire manufacturer every year, but like, you know, shake things up, because that way it's how quickly can different teams and
so
different drivers.
So you want to take the same tire manufacturer and shake them once a year?
Yes, I would like Pirelli to be just shaken, you know, every once in a while, because it's interesting, because, you know, seeing first it was. At Australia, everyone was just trying to sort of figure out heads or tails of the whole thing, and there was lots to change, and it was sort of seeing the potential of, KERS only versus KERS Endurs, and kind of how that would all happen, and it was sort of seeing all that happen in real life.
How are the TERS going to work with the KERS and the DERS?
and then there was sort of less of the focus on qualifying, because, oh, tire management is the key, and then they're kind of back to this qualifying thing now, like, well, if we can get up front, then it makes more of a difference, and then, you know, seeing how the passes work, and I mean, there were a fair amount of passes today. DRS definitely had an effect, but it wasn't like Turkey. I mean, it wasn't like every lap there was almost a pass, you know, just people switching positions and all that. So it was actually, you know, kind of a different, you know, different feel to it, because just, I don't know, the way the DRS zone was or what it was.
Like, here's what I'm wondering. Nick Heidfeld. This is Heidfeld we're talking about here. Not the fastest guy in pit lane. And not the best passer either. And he started dead last, mm-hmm. but he had good chunk of tires because his car caught fire and he couldn't participate in qualifying.
Because it was pretty serious car fire.
Yeah, P3 car fire. And he finished eighth. I would be willing to put money down that if a Red Bull car didn't qualify at all, but had completely fresh tires, that they could still win the race. I don't know if qualifying has that much importance. I think it's a higher risk because you have more people to pass and more opportunities to get in accidents and get in, you know, calamities, that kind of stuff. And it might be harder to find clean air, but there seems to be enough of a difference between tires and all the other things that, you know, you could, there's enough of advantage of keeping fresh tires that you don't necessarily need that P1 position.
Yeah, and I think all the working groups and all the time and effort that so many people have put into developing KERS, DERS, and TERS to all kind of work together.
We should put a counter on to see how many times those three phrases get mentioned.
We should. That'd be good. I think they've gotten about the right balance, because, of course, you don't want everyone to just be passing and passing back every lap. I mean, the end of this race was essentially, as it came down to be, was Hamilton versus Vettel. Hamilton right behind in second, just trying to catch up to Vettel, and he'd catch him by the end of the straight every time on the front straight, but not by enough to actually make a pass.
Uh-huh.
And then Vettel was just faster through the corners and you know, was using his KERS a little bit differently when he had it. So we don't want a case where every lap they're just passing and passing back to make it that easy. But what we haven't seen... I think they've gotten about the right balance, is where someone who's obviously faster just cannot get by. I think that was the big problem of overtaking being so hard.
Sure.
Was just like, we can tell this guy's faster. It's just there's no way for him to get around, and it just makes it tough. So without having, without making it too easy to pass, I think they've actually gotten pretty much the right balance to be able to not have these guys be held up and you know, so maybe for the, over the course of a lap, but then usually by the front straight hit the DRS, get around the car and away you go. So I have to give, you know, all the teams that have worked on that, you know, credit for, I think they've got about the right balance.
Interesting. Yeah. I think it's certainly exciting. Qualifying had become an extremely exciting event to watch, and I think they might have lost a little bit of that. I'm certainly not suggesting that qualifying is now boring, but it used to be so important, and the emphasis and the efforts and the different, you know, the different attempts you would see drivers do was quite a lot of fun to watch. I think they've lost a little bit of that, and I would be interested if someone in a really top team, if it were McLaren or let's say Hamilton or Vettel, ended up in a situation where for some reason they could not participate in qualifying,
mm-hmm.
but they had all their tires and they're fine for the race. It'd be very interesting to see how well they fared, because it could be an advantage. It could be an advantage because you're not running the same risk of being held up in traffic like way before, because of what you just talked about. It's just so hard to pass.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anymore. So it could almost, it'd be interesting to see that. If, like, you had three totally fresh set of soft tires, totally fresh, you know, could you you know, hold your own, stay competitive, and then the last stint, put those brand new fresh tires on that no one else has and just go to town on everybody.
Yeah, because that's what always seems interesting is when you end up with this reverse strategy where everyone else is just kind of maintaining on hards and you can just tear through the field on a fresh set of softs because right. at that point everybody's light, and then just to be able to combine the fresh set of really sticky rubber with low fuel. And so, I mean, we'll see because, you know, Monaco, I think of all the races, especially this year with the passing and all that, you know, it's not going to be easy to make a pass at Monaco. Uh-huh. It may be easier. And there was debate over whether they would even have DRS at this race, and it sounds like they will have that. I guess it would have to be kind of out from the front straight. I mean, there's no straight. I mean, you don't
right.
down the hill from underneath the hotel.
That's too
that
short.
Just seems dangerous.
Yeah, I think that's too short. And you're talking about through the tunnel.
You don't want it through the tunnel
because there's actually. I think you need the downforce through
yeah,
the tunnel.
Yeah, I think you do. And then down the hill, you're pretty much on the brakes pretty quick. So yeah, I don't. I guess we'll have to. It would have to be the front straight, or maybe that run up the hill after turn one. But then,
yeah, but that's not straight
that's
either.
That's curves. There's no straight at Monaco.
Yeah.
So we'll see exactly how that comes to play. So I think those will have less of an advantage. So qualifying will be important, and what I guess will be interesting will be who can manage the wing to have what you've really always wanted. You know, at Monaco is just all the downforce you could ever ask for. Just crank the wing all the way on for all the corners, and then for those few. You know, could maybe less than a second over the course of a lap, but
right.
could be, you know, just a few seconds worth where you just don't have that downforce and you have, you know, a wide open control over DRS for qualifying. That could be a pretty good shootout. That could be pretty fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I'm definitely excited to see Monaco, but, you know, it still bothers me a little bit. I still am definitely looking forward to the day where we can build a car that fundamentally is just easier to pass and isn't as disturbed by, you know, other cars' wake and things like that, because, you know, Kurs and Durs is fun, but it's not, to me, it's still a little bit disingenuous. I you know what I mean? Like, I kind of want to see cars that don't get advantages over each other at certain points, but rather, you know, one guy is faster in a car than another person. And that car isn't designed in such a way to make it really difficult to pass.
I agree. And I think what's been interesting is that, if anything, Kurs, Durs, and Turs have shown what's possible, right? So right now it's through some add-ons.
Ah, that's interesting.
And
yeah,
some
okay.
weird, okay, what if it's got an electric motor, but you can only use it for this amount? And what if you do this? You know, what if the tires do this? So it's kind of shown, like, this is what it would be like if it were easier to overtake. So maybe now they have a target to say, can we accomplish this without all the crazy rules and
right.
without all the crazy add-ons? Because
right.
now we've seen how it can be, how Formula One can be different than just whoever's on pole pretty much goes on to win the race,
right.
unless there's a big crash and whatever. And you know, I've been thinking a lot about this, the safety car issue and how long it's been since we've had major crashes and so on. And there was a lot of concern, especially after Mark Webber in Valencia, you know, coming up behind Heikki Kovalainen and becoming very
right.
much airborne,
yep. uh-huh.
and thinking, okay, wow, this closing speeds, you know, if you've got the wing open and he doesn't and blah, 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 there's going to be these big closing speeds. That hasn't been a problem at all. I mean, really, yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, I agree.
There have been
yeah,
maybe some moments, but I don't think any more than normal just moments there would be. So I think maybe because people don't have to try these really oddball, probably not going to work Hail Mary kind of passes because you've been stuck behind a guy for 10 laps. You know, in the old days, you may have had to really get desperate and had to try something that was just never going to work, but hey, otherwise I'm just stuck here forever. That it may actually have been, you know, I mean, clearly we've seen fewer crashes. We still haven't had a safety car, you know, this whole season. And to, you know, I think it's kind of an unintended outcome from having all these aids.
Yeah, in a positive way. That's an interesting thought for sure. And I think that it's definitely a very happy way to not have safety cars, you know, because in some ways the safety cars were part of what brought out some excitement in races in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, there's a safety car, bunches up the field, there's opportunities to pass, tires cool down, et cetera, right? So, but to have the excitement without having to have a safety car in the first place and people going off is definitely a good idea. Although I to kind of build on this point, of our Urs family, I think the Kurs can definitely be implemented in a different way, because the one thing I don't like, if you, you know, there's a lot of hybrid vehicles out there in production, right? And we've got a couple of full-on electric cars that are like, you know, full vehicle cars. I'm not talking about like GEM golf cart, Glowfire golf carts with turn signals.
But like a Nissan Leaf, and there's some electric
Nissan Leaf,
Prius,
the Chevy
now.
Volt, kind of close enough. And, you know, more plug-in and even more serious electric cars are coming through the pipeline. You know, Ford has promised one and so on and so forth,
yeah.
Right? Anyway, the point is those are all automatic. You don't hit a button. You don't hit a button on your Prius to make the hybrid system work, right? It
yeah.
just works. And I think that, you know, they had this idea about KERS, like it's a boost and blah, blah, blah. I think, okay, it was fun for a couple of years, but now this is an opportunity for Formula One to get more in line with production, you know, mainstream production vehicles, and come up with a ways to do it with, you know, with better technology, lighter weight, more efficiency, so on and so forth. So let KERS be automatic, not involving the driver in a direct sense. I mean, you could have Leafs on the steering wheel if you want or whatever.
Turn on eco mode.
Exactly. But, you know, let it be automatic and definitely let the engineers play. It's like try to get more horsepower than the other guy or get more use, like have it work more often than not and things like that. Let the engineers work with mapping on when it should it come on. Should it come on all the time when the engine's at lower RPM for more torque? Is it, should it come on in the straights? Like, whatever.
Yeah.
It seems like there's a lot of, you know, the engineering technology side that wouldn't hurt the racing because you have these other things that make it, you know, make it easier to pass.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and Mark Webber said exactly that in an interview, that KERS basically is a net zero for everyone because everyone has it. Everyone has the same amount of it. And if you hit the KERS, you know, the other guy is probably going to hit the KERS at the
right.
same spot on the track. So you both get a power boost, and there's no net difference there. So it might as well be, you know, there may be a little bit of strategy, you know, Lewis Hamilton trying to use it differently against Vettel and kind of save it up for different parts of the lap wherever you're slow. But none of that was actually enough to make a difference and enough to, like, have him rocket it right around Vettel. I mean, it was still not that much of a difference. So I think it's a, certainly a good point, and I think something that could be built in. I think on the other side, too, if they can find, you know, just engineers developing this, if they weren't limited to how much power could be used on the output side, then there'd be an incentive to develop a system that can regenerate more. And I think that's technology that can make its way into road cars, of saying, how can we, you know, just capture as much energy as possible out of every brake stop, not just light ones, not just heavy ones, but any
Absolutely.
Kind of brake stop, whether it's, a, you know, just for a few tenths of a second, whether it's for multiple seconds, and, you know, and be smart about it and be interested. I mean, who knows if there's some part of a switchable rear wing that would then, you know, route air into something to generate some power. I mean, who knows? You know, but if the guys are right now, I think everyone.
Yeah. Before we know, the exhaust gases will be spinning something like
yeah.
instead of turbos,
they'll
turbocharge the KERS somehow.
And there'll be turbos as well. You know, so
yeah.
it'll be that's the kind of thing that I think would be really interesting. And, you know, just let them, you know, get these guys free reign with KERS. And I guess then you're getting back into the cost argument because HRT can't afford to go crazy with KERS. But, you know, that's not really relevant to a road car anyway. So that's a little bit, you know, it's I guess a tough road to go down. But I think that would make it more interesting racing and more interesting relevance to the real world. And I've heard actually, and this seems crazy, but that, you know, Porsche is talking about having KERS on their new 911s, which, as Porsche is not in Formula One or nor Audi or Volkswagen or anything related, it seems a little bit weird that they would brand it as such. I mean, I could see Ferrari maybe going that way.
Yeah.
You know, Red Bull doesn't make road cars. McLaren only makes one road car. It's like, you know, there's not really manufacturers so much anymore. But, you know, I guess, but people are more aware of, like, hey, we could, this, you know, hybrid doesn't necessarily mean Prius. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a really slow car. And I guess Lexus has done that with some of these, you know, big, you know, what, the LS600H or whatever, which
right.
is this giant car. And so it still gets 18 miles per gallon, but it's like, oh, it's a hybrid.
Right, right.
For, you know, better performance rather than for actually for economy. So,
well, yeah, it's interesting that it's going into proper sports cars because there's been a couple of attempts to not sell hybrid as a eco thing, but as a performance thing. Like the Honda Accord, for example. The Honda Accord Hybrid mm-hmm. was the fastest Honda Accord you could buy. You know.
Really?
Yeah.
Those IMA cars were so slow.
Oh, not the Accord. It
I
was
guess,
quick.
Because
it was a V6 Accord with the extra boost and the extra torque.
Yeah, because I was thinking
it
about,
was properly fast.
It's because Honda's hybrid system was probably the most like KERS in that it was just like they can use a smaller displacement engine, and that's the only reason we'll get better fuel economy, because, and the only reason it's not super slow and unsafely slow is because we've got this motor that's in line with it.
Right.
You know, it couldn't run
on... And it's simpler, it's lighter.
It couldn't run as electric only like the Prius can and whatever, but, you know, neither can these F1 cars. So it's funny that Honda, who has now obviously divested themselves entirely from F1, actually would have probably had the most relevance toward, you know, between racing and street cars, to kind of the way they do hybrids happens to be the way that F1 wants them. And,
And
especially, I guess, with F1, and I put this in the biggest air quotes I can come up with, going green as far as fuel economy and turbos and all that, it's interesting how this changed. And I guess I wonder if these car companies start to turn around, which seems like they are, if we actually might get some more manufacturers, you know, interested in F1 again.
But we digress. Anyway, so it's a very interesting conversation, and, you know, be interested to see how that comes in the future. But I think maybe getting back to the point a little bit, Sebastian Vettel. Wow. I mean, what a performance, right? It really looked like, with about 16 laps to go, that Hamilton, for whatever reason, had a better set of tires or a better setup, and he was reeling Vettel in. And with 10 laps to go, he was on top of him. And Vettel wouldn't let him by. It was pretty damn impressive.
Yeah, it was just sort of a classic battle, I think, of Lewis trying everything he could, curs, durs, and turs wise.
Oh, goodness, 15.
and it just, you know, Vettel just had his number and was able to hold on to it. So it's funny that the way this season...
And his number was 42.
The way the season has gone, that second place, like, if you're the next best guy to the Red Bull, that's pretty much like a victory. Right
I
now.
Mean, even for Hamilton. Hamilton's saying, well, we can't be disappointed with this.
Yeah.
You know, it's clear. Yeah, absolutely.
And then Button, of course, behind him, you know, way behind him. But so, you know, Button having gotten around Weber and Alonso through a combination of pits and, you know, his different strategy. So, you know, a good result for McLaren. But, I mean, the Constructors' Championship is so Red Bull heavy.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, it's hard to see this changing unless something really different happens in some future races. And I think this may be part of the side effect of the safety cars and all that, but what was interesting about this, so Sebastian Vettel finished the race, and then, you know, with Lewis Hamilton right behind him at the line, it was 0.6 seconds behind him, so
right.
he was right there. And then Jensen, 35 seconds back, 35 seconds off of Vettel, and Mark Webber, 48 seconds behind Vettel, so they're pretty well spaced back, and those were the last guys in the lead lap. There's only four cars on the lead lap.
Wow.
Everywhere from fifth place Alonso on down to... Narain Karthikeyan, who was five laps down in the HRT, had been lapped. So, I mean, it got so spaced out, by the end of it. We did have two retirements, actually three, I guess, with Felipe Massa's just off at the end there. I don't know if it's something actually broke or if he just
We didn't follow up on that one specifically,
yeah.
And it just, the only video coverage we saw was him already,
yeah.
You know, pulling off Saigon. I don't know if it was a failure of some kind. It certainly didn't look like a crash. It looked like a mechanical failure of some kind.
Failure of either the car or the driver. But, so three retirements. So, you know, again, these guys at the back of the field, you know, these poor guys in the HRTs, you know, do the entire race and end up 21st. You know, it's like there's just not as much attrition as used to help these guys out. But yeah, it was very well spaced out. And I think actually part of your point about if one of the guys in the top teams were to start at the back. That is one thing that would, you know, potentially go you know, away from them, is because if they don't have the safety car to bunch everybody back up and also have that restart potentially with DERS even as well. I mean, I don't know how if they then, you know, disable DRS behind the safety car, whatever, you're not going to pass. But on a restart, because if everyone's in a line, you just see all the wings open up.
I guess
there's no benefit except for the guy in front. But, it's could be kind of interesting to see that. And that without that. Because these guys are, you know, two, three, four, five laps down that end up finishing the race. But, it'd be tough, I think, you know, moving your way up through the field and getting all that all going without the off safety car to get everything bunched back up.
So speaking of racing and the safety car and stuff like that, the other thing that kind of struck me today, and we've seen it in the past, but it really seems stark today, the pole time for Weber was a 1 minute 20.9, mm-hmm. something, right? The lap times at the beginning of the race, and, you know, they didn't improve that much as they went, was in the 31s. So they were 10 seconds a lap slower from qualifying pace to race pace. Now, I know they got a full tank of fuel, but still, that just blows my mind.
Well, you don't get DRS, you know, like you don't get free use of DRS like you do in qualifying.
Yes.
And I guess it'd be interesting if we could kind of one by one sort of eliminate these variables, because there's fuel is obviously a big one.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the race, then they're back down to practically empty fuel.
Right.
Although then strategically they don't need to push so hard. I mean, although Vettel and Hamilton must have been going as fast as they possibly could have.
Well, that's what it seems like. You know, it's like, you know, for example, I think the fastest lap of the race was a 27.3 or something like that. I'd have to look. But, you know.
It was a 26.7, actually. 26.7. Lewis Hamilton.
Still, that's 5 seconds plus off of pole time. And we're now on empty fuel. Now, again, there's 2 seconds delta between a fresh hard compound tire and a fresh soft compound tire.
Mm-hmm.
There's still 3 seconds on the table. Do you know what I mean? It's light fuel now. Mm-hmm. It's still 3 seconds. They're fighting for each other, so it's not like there's really tire conservation mode. So is there another 3 seconds in the fact that it's now a used tire? I mean, but you see my point. Is that just – seems like the gaps are huge, and they never really seem to recover. So is it just that they're heroic in qualifying and they just don't get to that same edge in the race because the car will completely fall apart? Do you see what I'm getting at here?
Well, now that I'm thinking about it more and how much of a difference that wing makes, you know, having – I can see a few tenths on maybe – I don't know about on every straightaway, but even on these mid-level straights, and it was pretty wild seeing the guys – you know, the last corner, you've got kind of this left-right chicane. Or it's kind of a dog leg. I mean, it's a bit big for a chicane, I guess, here at Barcelona. And then you've got kind of this sweeping right-hander onto the front straight. And in practice and qualifying, you saw these guys, like, basically just at the exit of the chicane opening up that rear wing. So they're still in a pretty serious – they've probably got about 90 degrees of turning to do.
Uh-huh.
And yet they are off that wing, and they're just getting that speed. And, of course, that's all going to be multiplied by the end of the straight and all that. So it'd be interesting to do – to use, you know, some, like, real-time – lap comparison technology, predictive lap, to sort of see, you know, set a lap with, you know, a qualifying lap only using, you know, or with no DRS, maybe. And then, you know, go back in, get the same tires, you know, try to eliminate as many variables as possible and just see how much different that wing makes. Because that, it could be a lot. I mean, you know, in Barcelona, they've got some medium speed corners and some straights, so, you know, it could take advantage of the wing. That's what something like Monaco, where I don't know that it'll make that much of a difference.
Yeah.
And we may see some crashes in practice or qualifying from people getting a little overeager with the wing. I mean, I don't know, you know, how unsettled the car would be if you starts to get squirrely if you're like on the way up the hill and you've got the wing open to try to go faster. And
think about how busy your hands are at Monaco in general.
And then you get off the wing, like how that'll then, you know, bring a lot of rear downforce back on. I mean, that may do you more harm than good. It may be tricky to see. So that could be part of the fun. But yeah, just to kind of see that all you know, see exactly what what difference the wing is. But because what's sort of neat about that, and I guess Kerr's to a lesser extent, is that those things can sort of change and evolve. So we've already seen an announcement from the FIA saying that starting in Canada, they're going to have 2 DRS zones instead of just 1.
Yes.
So you sort of start to realize, like, okay, we've sort of taken it, and as it has been so far this year, as the single DRS zone, and it's always pretty much the main straight, and it's kind of, you know, that's where you can use it. But they can play with that and tweak that to make the racing more interesting through the season without, you know, massive rule changes and all that. So that could be interesting to see, you know, how much of a difference, if that is a second a lap different, you know, using the wing or not, and then how much they want to actually tweak that around the lap and how short they might make DRS zones and those kind of things. That could sort of change over time. It could be pretty interesting.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Well, I mean, we can say for the first time this year, at least for me personally, this was not the most exciting race of the season. I think for me, Turkey was the pinnacle. I think you said you liked China the most. But this one was a little bit more subdued, but still very fascinating, very interesting, and, you know, had different dimensions to it.
It was actually, just looking at the timing, it was 9 minutes longer than Turkey, but it seemed like it was like 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was just...
It was a while.
Yeah.
But Monaco's going to be fantastic. Hugely looking forward to that. So definitely excited to see. Because, again, that's exactly what you're saying. You know, where these the Kurs and Durs, at least, cannot play as big of a role because there's a lot less need to have an extra 80 horsepower in a lot of places.
You don't have a 100-foot-wide track.
Right, and there's a lot less need to open that rear wing up because you want as much wing as possible in most places. So it's going to be fun to watch drivers really get into it. And, you know, the big question for me at least is going to be, and we'll get to this more once we get to predictions, is, you know, how is raw talent, since it plays a bigger factor, going to stack up for Vettel? How is Vettel's raw talent going to go up against Alonso's and Hamilton's and things like that? And again, the Red Bull chassis, which is famous for, you know, the high speed downforce, medium high speed downforce, there's not as much of that here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot more as much downforce as possible, low speed kind of stuff. So is that going to play into the other team's hands a little bit, where mechanical grip becomes a little bit more important, so on and so forth?
Yeah, and on a sort of related note, you know, as you're just thinking, you know, the whole raw talent in Monaco, and it's sort of just a test of your attachments almost. You know, it's a little bit less about the gadgets in the car. As it makes me, you know, it's making me miss Robert Kubica, basically. You know,
after
his sort of breakout performance in the Renault, and then, you know, just challenging the Red Bulls and almost out of nowhere, you know, to see this really, really good performance, and that's just one. And thankfully, we haven't talked about him in a little while, but he's out of the hospital now. He's doing, you know, physical training and, you know, sort of recuperating. There's no date on his return to racing or whatever, but, you know, more importantly, it's just that he's doing better and he's improving, that at least he can have a, you know, return to normal, happy life.
Yes.
And so even if he doesn't get to go racing again, it would be a shame, but at least, you know, he's recovering well. And, but man, it would be great to see someone, because that, even the Renault car this year, I mean, I think in the hands of Kubica could really do some magic stuff, because in the hands of Heidfeld and Petrov, they've had some pretty solid performances.
Absolutely.
And I think someone like Robert around Monaco would just be stellar. And, you know, it's a shame he won't be able to race this year, but, you know, just thought of my boy for a second.
Oh, well, yeah.
There.
Well, sure. Well, with that in mind, you know, one of the rumors that's going around, which who knows, of course, is that even if he does return to racing, even if he does return to Formula One, it might not be with Renault.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely rumors that continue to swirl about Kubica having a Ferrari deal in hand coming as early as 2013.
And we know they wouldn't be firing Alonso, partly because he's a much, much better driver than Massa.
And also because he just signed on through 2016.
Exactly.
So, and, you know, so freaking if Massa. We can just hypothesize for a moment. I don't know how a Kubica-Alonso pairing would go.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about Ferrari, I mean, partly, of course, it's just the success of the team, and it's, you know, like any other team. It's just how can you do? But there's also this, it's Ferrari. It's something special.
It's the history.
It's Italian. Yeah. It's kind of the heritage. And that's partly why, like, Kimi Raikkonen just never really fit in there. Even though he had success, and, yeah, you know, they had their world championship and everything. You just don't, and you'd see some fan support for Kimi, but I think the vast majority of support, especially around Europe and everything, was for Massa, just because it's sort of, you know, he's, you know, got whatever, you know, Latin heritage. He's not actually, you know, from Brazil, but not from Italy or anything, but just kind of felt more connected to sort of the Ferrari ethos.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Raikkonen was just not that guy. And I'm not sure Robert Kubica is that guy either. You know, like Alonso, it's a great fit. You know, it's not Italian again, but it's sort of close enough. And obviously all the Spanish fans love him. And it's Ferrari, so the fans all over the world that really are going to go after that. And I think Alonso fits that. He's not, you know, a young, scrappy up-and-comer, but he's not, you know, old man Schumacher or whatever. He's like just kind of the right guy for Ferrari.
And he's also, I mean, he proved again today, he's fantastically fast. As much as he sets himself up as the perfect villain, he still is quite quick. It's very clear in his performances.
That's
so
true.
You know, it'd be interesting to see. And I certainly don't think Kubica would walk in and like take over the team. But I think it would not be, again, it would be more of that Alonso Hamilton situation at McLaren in 2007, where, you know, are you the clear number one anymore, Alonso? No. You know what I mean? Like,
who's number one and who do we put our weight behind when it comes down to it? And, yeah, I mean, and I guess the other sort of story like that has been the Red Bull teammates, of how, you know, Weber's been off his game, and then, the, you know, Vettel's just been cleaning up with everything and kind of the back and forth there. And they've been civil in all the interviews and everything, and, you know, kind of these half-hearted pats on the back and whatever. So sort of on the surface, it seems like, yeah, okay, things are okay, you know, they're not like, you know, not Alonso Hamilton bad, of like really making it obvious that they have very little respect for each other. So they're at least cordial, but you know, it really doesn't seem like Weber would want to stay at Red Bull next year. you know, just based on kind of some of the interviews he's had, oh, yeah, we're going to wait and see on 2012, and, you know, just kind of the support behind Vettel and so on. There's still a lot of the season to go, though, and all those things could change because, as you and I have talked about, even if you're not the happiest person in the world as far as who your teammate is and you know, how happy you are when you're in interviews, you want to be in a race-winning car more than you want to be, you know, just in any car in F1. I think, you know, Heikki Kovalainen could probably speak to that a little bit, and Heidfeld and a couple of these guys that have been in winning cars and not made the most of it. And or even, you know, Rubens Barrichello. I mean, he's been miserable lately with the poor performance of the Williams and all that. And to see, you know, how close he's been to with championship points and everything, you know, from the Braun days, from Ferrari, from everything. And then to just languishing around and having mechanical problems. So, you know, it could be tricky. But, yeah, I mean, Kubica, I would love to see him race again. And who knows? I mean, in another couple of years, maybe the Mercedes will be the car to beat and, you know, or whatever. It's probably not going to, you know.
Yeah, well. Who knows? Exactly. Anyway, oh, what a race. Good stuff. But I think we've talked enough.
Let's hear from the fans. So this was one of the rare opportunities where I could have watched the race live when I did for the Turkish Grand Prix.
And not have it be crack dawn.
Yeah.
You'd actually get a decent night's sleep and do it.
Yeah, and which is crazy. Being in Iceland, the sun had already been up for like 12 hours by the time the race was on at 9 a.m. Yeah. It's kind of weird there. But so we had the usual contingent of Twitter followers that would, you know, tweeting along with us at the race. So Cam McGrath, man, he's in Australia, and I don't know what time zone he lives on because he's up for every single race. He's always there. So shout out to him. It's always always fun to see his retweets and talking to us and all that. And, you know, just as we've mentioned for anyone, if you want, sort of, you know, follow us on Facebook for the kind of general news and updates. We've got a great contingent of fans there that post stories and links, and we try to keep up with that as well. But if you want any kind of the real-time stuff for just quick little updates and blurbs and little kind of things that that happen in passing, follow at the F1 Show on Twitter because it's great fun, and we've got a nice little community going on there.
Absolutely, and it's been active as ever. But first and foremost, we have comments on the F1 Show page itself, f1show.com. Of course, that's where all the real action is. That's where the coolest people hang out. Pretty straightforward, actually. Elliot said, hey, great show about China and KL. Looking forward to the next show. Thank you, Elliot. And Henry Lake said, hey, guys, great show. Happy birthday to you, Guy, for about 2 weeks ago. I think that's towards you, sir.
That would have been, because your birthday's December.
Yeah. It's great to see someone other than Vettel win the race in China. What a race for Weber, finishing third from 18th. Spanish predictions, Vettel, Weber, can't wait for Turkey and Spain podcast. So that prediction...
was a little bit backwards.
A little bit backwards, but you know, sterling effort either way. Yes. So anyway, on to Facebook, where it was active as always. Lots of good stuff from Craig Wilson, Neil Popham, Sean Scanlon. And Sean posted a article yesterday that I think everyone should take a look at. F1 News, Ferrari not ruling out a Hamilton swoop. Ferrari suggesting that they may try to pair Hamilton and Alonso together.
What could possibly go wrong?
I think for many reasons that's extremely unlikely, but it's fun to hear the bosses talk about things like that. And I think, just like we talked about in the episode, there's always for every driver that pull towards Ferrari, almost regardless. Even if Ferrari isn't the dominant team at the moment, which it clearly isn't, you know, I think that would still be very desirable for a lot of people.
Yeah, I could see a Vettel-Hamilton lineup at Red Bull much easier than I could see a Hamilton-Alonso lineup at any team.
At any team. Vettel, including Vettel-Alonso lineup at McDonald's. I think it would be just as bad as, like, oh, you're cutting in front of me and there'd be Coke and French fries flying everywhere. They don't belong together.
Yeah, so Hamilton, I don't know. I mean, obviously he's had this McLaren history since he was 2 years old and all that. So
yeah, I mean, 10, I think it is, actually,
which is still extremely young. It'd be kind of a big deal to do that, but at the same time, if he's, you know, not getting what he needs out of McLaren, I don't know. It's one of those, I think it may have been an interview where you know, they said, oh, well, what about this car? It must be terrible, right? And, you know, they just kind of keep badgering him on these questions. And eventually he goes, well, yeah, it'd be nicer if the car was faster. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, Lewis Hamilton wants to quit McLaren or whatever. So it may be more of, you know, less of a story than it seems.
And it seems like, I think the Kubica rumor has a lot more gumption, a lot more promise to it than the Hamilton, right? Because, you know, McLarens have been pretty consistently faster than Ferraris these last few years, basically since Hamilton's been in the sport.
Yeah.
So.
So, as always, to visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page or any of that, the best place to go is to f1show.com, and you can see all of our old episodes if you want to relive what happened years ago at any of these races, or, you know, hear, you know, what it sounded like when a race report happened before there was curs, durs, and turs, then you can go relive the magic. And as always,
and it is magic.
And we appreciate all your comments, questions, feedback, and suggestions, and all that.
And unlike usual, we actually have something a little extra for you. If you guys want to venture on over to YouTube, that is YouTube.com.
In case you're as old as Rob and you don't know about YouTube.
In case, because you might be, if you're not a child on Twitter. And check out a brand new video we posted in Iceland of Jim and I. So it's a quick little thing. But if you type in F1show.com and you spell out the dot, so it's F1show, DOTCOM, that's our username on YouTube, and you can see our latest video.
Or even easier, just follow the link that we'll post. How about that?
Ooh, Mr. Technology, fine. Whatever. You can do that too. But anyway, check out a little video. It's stupid and short, and you guys kind of got a sneak preview of it already. But it's video.
There you go.
Everyone loves video.
Trivia.
Absolutely, you know what that song means. It is time for trivia. And the last episode, we gave you a humdinger, I would say. And the question was...
It was a one-parter.
It was a one-fer. And it was... Are we going to get to the question or not?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay. The question was, where does the name Formula One come from? The name Formula One, or as the French say, Formula... probably not really. But
that's
anyway.
Not really what they say.
And Jim, please bestow us with the answer.
All right. Well, as you prepared in this document here, formula refers to the single set of rules that every team must comply. One refers to the fact that this is the peak, highest formula that can be achieved.
Right.
So it's sort of, you know, the number one specification or highest spec or whatever. Originally, it was Formula A. So it was first originally defined in 1946 by the Commission Sportive Internationale of the FIA, forerunner of FISA.
And if I can just add, duh.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that. As the premier single-seater racing category in worldwide motorsport. So initially known as Formula A, but the name Formula One was widely used early on, and actually in 1950, the beginning of the constructor in driver's champion, not constructor, but the driver Formula One World Championship.
Yeah. That's constructors' the name championship was 58.
Was way, I think. Yeah, yeah, it's way later. So that's when the name officially became used, was 1950, the beginning of the modern era, current championship setup, and all that.
Yeah, so it's kind of a nerdy, engineering, techie way to name a series, but you know, it works. Works for me.
It does. And interestingly enough, so everyone calls it, or most everyone calls it, F1, and there's no trademark on F1 because it's too vague.
Right.
So it's kind of funny. So like how we can be the F1 show and we're not sued into oblivion, partly because Bernie Ecclestone has never heard of us.
Right.
But even if he has heard of us, then what's up, Bernie, if you listen?
What we're trying to say is we're stealth.
Yeah, we're under the radar. Well, no, because it's, you know, there's a key on everyone's on keyboard that says F1 on it. So if that were trademarked, right, you'd have to have, you know.
And like, I hear Apple pays millions to Bernie for that.
But so what's kind of funny is if you search for F1, depending on what else you search for, there's places because F1 on Windows systems is like the help key. So there's like F1 computer solutions, and I'm like, Cool, what is that? Oh, it's just computer place.
Right. So IT support or something.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, it's Formula One officially, but F1, as much as I'm sure Bernie would love to trademark F1,
absolutely,
cannot be. So that's why they always spell it out as FOMC, and it's all...
Right. Trademarks are fun, right? Because I love hearing stories about unsuccessful ones. For example, I happen to know for a fact that Mercedes tried to trademark the letters A, E, C, and S, and the number combination, the letter combinations, a CL, CLK, SL. They try to trademark all those, and they're like, dude, those are letters. You can't trademark those. And my favorite one of all time is Harley Davidson tried to trademark the sound that their motorcycle engines make, the lumpy sounds, the bum, 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 bum.
Yeah.
They wanted to trademark that sound as a Harley sound, and they're like, no,
you cannot
trademark a sound.
That.
Right.
You can trademark, you can have copyright on a recording of a sound, but of the actual sound. Although, interestingly, the 911, Porsche 911, was originally going to be the 901, but Peugeot had the, I guess it's not really a trademark, or maybe it is, of a three-digit car name for a car that's a three-digit number where the middle is a zero. They have the trademark on that, so that's why they have 206 and 306 and 308 and all those 407. So Porsche was like, well, we can't use a zero, we will use a one, and it's 911, and it has been ever since.
Isn't that something? Yeah. I did not know that.
Well, we've all learned something today. So
that's what's so great about the F1 show.
All right, but do we have a trivia question for next episode?
Of course we do. I believe it's on that same document you're looking at.
Oh, I will read that then. I'll just go into it. Who is the oldest living F1 drivers champion?
Yes.
And we see these guys come up as stewards every once in a while. And
yes.
We see, some of these guys that have become sort of ambassadors for the sport and all that. But, the oldest, living as of now, hopefully, and for a long, long time in the future.
Right. Can I make a guess?
Yes.
Can I guess right now?
Yeah.
F1 show exclusive. Michael Schumacher.
No.
You sure? He's old.
He's like, what, 85
He's
now?
Like, I thought, in his 80s. Well, if octogenarian for sure.
If Rubens
maybe it's
had,
early 80s.
If Rubens had been champion, then he might be in the race. Anyway.
Rubens is younger than Michael by 2 or 3 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Michael's in his 40s. Rubens is 39.
Dang.
Yeah.
Rubens is only 39?
I think so.
His dad looks younger than
him. I know.
Okay.
Or I could be totally wrong. That's also possible. Maybe Rubens 39 in metric years.
Yeah. It's probably metric years. To answer that question, feel free to contact us on any of the methods we mentioned a moment ago on f1show.com.
I'm still pretty sure it's Michael Schumacher, though. I would guess Michael Schumacher.
Well, you can guess that. In the meantime, we are going to talk about predictions. So that brings us to prediction time. And again, we're doing kind of one of these races where we're covering two races in one show, so it's a little bit complicated. But to start with Turkey, neither of us were spot on. I think we both had...
But we were on the spot, and that's part of the reason why we weren't spot on.
Yes, if that makes any sense.
It does.
So you have the thing in front of you?
I do, almost.
Oh.
I am doing, pre-21st century stuff. I'm looking at an Excel spreadsheet, and I'm deleting things that aren't necessary.
Using your abacus over there.
Exactly. So let's see. Turkey. Ah. Yes, Jim, you had Vettel on pole position.
Which is correct.
It is. But you had Weber to win the race.
And which was not correct.
That's also not correct. And I had Weber to be on pole position, which was incorrect. And I also had Weber to win the race, which was incorrect. So you won that round, but we both did very well. You scored 1 point total. I scored 2. And very well for us. The stat model said that since Vettel won the race, Vettel was on pole last time, and Hamilton won the race last time, that's China, that he would do it again in Turkey. That was not the case. Vettel was on pole, but indeed Hamilton ended up, where did he end up? Second or something? Third? Third. Was Hamilton third? Where was Hamilton in Turkey? I don't remember.
No, I've got that. He was fourth.
Fourth. Ooh, look at that. Mm. 3 whole points for the statistical model. What a shame. And on to Spain, sir.
Yes, so our predictions were a little bit late because we didn't have a show, but using our number one fan, Neil Popham's brilliant Facebook app, I was able to log some predictions. And it was funny because I was doing this on Friday, so I'm kind of reading through my news feed about, Ferrari's, blah, blah, blah. And then it was like, Weber had fastest print time in practice. And I'm like, Weber, maybe this is his time. Maybe Weber's coming around.
Right.
I actually had a prediction set for, I think, Weber, Vettel, maybe. And then I was like, because he's... Vettel always comes up with it at the last second. Like, anyone else can look good in qualifying. We've seen good runs out of the McLarens or the Ferraris, but Vettel always just comes back and gets it. So I actually went back and changed my prediction to be Vettel Hamilton, and I ended up being wrong for qualifying, of course, because we got Mark Webber was on pole. So if I hadn't second guessed myself. And I don't know who I had to win at that point, but at one point I was like, oh, Vettel, and then I was a little pro Weber, and then read one of those articles where Mark Weber's like, oh, you know, just because I did this good time in practice doesn't mean anything, and yeah, did Vettel's untouchable for pole
and
positions.
You're like, you know what, Mark, you're right.
yeah, fair enough. So yeah, so I did collect 2 points for being wrong about both qualifying and the race by one position each. So it's not a terrible performance, but it's not my best. You, on the other hand, did twice as well as I did.
Yes, I did. I thought that it was going to be Vettel, and I was wrong, as you were, about qualifying. Weber pulled it out, which was nice to see. I will happily take a point and see Weber get his pole position. I think he deserves one. And because, again, you know, here's the thing that everyone has to remember. Mark Webber isn't driving any worse than he did last year. I think it's pretty clear that Vettel is just doing so well. He's comfortable, he's confident, and it's still just as fast as he was before, but without all the uncertainty that he had otherwise. So he's just truly unstoppable now, right? So it was good for Webber to get that sense of being able to have the ultimate speed and show well for Red Bull, and I think, you know, Webber deserved it. Okay. Very long-winded way of saying that I was wrong. But I did have Vettel also win the race, and he did, although he definitely gave me a threat. Your prediction proved to be a pretty darn respectable one. It was just another 100 feet worth of durs away from you being right instead of me. So,
and it was a more bold prediction to not put Vettel to win the race, the, like, winningest driver of 2011 ever.
Right. And so, as the great Colonel Patton once said, it's much better to be bold than right. Actually, he didn't say that, and you were wrong.
Fair enough. However, so you have been the least wrong out of anyone who's been playing along with the predictions on facebook.com/F1show. There's a tab on the left side for predictions. If you haven't started taking part, it's never too late. You'll be at a very big disadvantage.
Unless it's Saturday, then it's too late.
Fair enough. So you out of all the predictions we've done so far since the second race, you've only been off by 3 positions total. So you've got 3 points, and lower scores are better. The statistical model's off by 5 points because it got a bunch of points for that Hamilton prediction.
That is a shame.
And then I got to give credit to our top four fans there: James Payne, Neil Popham, who wrote this app, so he might be cheating. We don't really know. But obviously a top bloke for putting this all together. Will Carver and Sean Scanlon, who are actually tied with 11 points each. And then my predictions put me 1 point behind there with 12 points. I'm in 7th spot overall.
Wow.
In terms of predictions. So, you know, I'm glad that at least that you're winning. I mean, that's great. That shows that at least what we are slightly more intelligent than a simple heuristic model. Or you are. I'm not. I'm much worse, but you know it's good to see that we're at least in the top 10 that I am anyway, and that's fun. So, next race. Luckily, we're both married now, so there won't be weddings. There is only a little bit of travel and so on in between now and then, but we will be able to be back to bring you a coverage of the Monaco Grand Prix. We shouldn't have to do one of these double shows again. So,
but we are it might as well say now we are probably going to do it on Monday, not Sunday.
Yes, but it'll be close.
It'll be close.
And that's a holiday for here, everyone here in the U.S., so it'll be Memorial Day. It'll be nice. And we have to rush right now to finish up to get to the airport because that's just kind of the way that we are. So
we're talking about Monaco now, right?
We're talking about Monaco, and it's raw speed, and it's dirge, and it's everything. And I'm actually going to go and put Hamilton on pole.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think this is Webber's first victory.
No kidding.
I think it is.
Really?
I think it's turning around for him.
Wow. Yep. That's all right. Now I have to say, I'm getting a strong Hamilton vibe myself from this whole thing.
Yeah.
I feel like it's tough. I'm really having a hard time between Vettel and Hamilton because I feel like, you know, all this talk about, well, is Red Bull, you know, the advantages Red Bull have might not be as strong here, and it's more about raw talent. And I think if you had to say who is the fastest driver on the grid right now, I think Hamilton is that person. And he's also in a very quick car. So I'm tempted to go Hamilton as well, but I cannot deny Vettel. You know what I mean? Like, I'm having a really, really hard time with this. So what I'm going to do, this is tough because I really like having a low score. I'm going to put Vettel on pole. I'm going to say he holds on to it.
Okay.
But I think...
making a safe bet. You know, that's fine.
We're going to have a repeat of China, and I think Hamilton's going to win.
Ooh.
That's what I think is going to happen.
All right. Well, I have made my prediction on the predictions page on our Facebook page.
So, and I have not, but I will.
It's in there. The statistical model, of course, is predicting Weber on pole and Vettel to win, which may work out to be a pretty good prediction there as well.
We're
not really sure yet.
Stupid.
But that's what makes it fun.
Stupid prediction statistic thing.
All right. So we've got only a week until a week and a day until our next show, until the next race in Monaco. And we're all looking forward to that. So keep in touch with us on F1Show.com. And in the meantime, have a great week. I am Jim Lau.
And I'm Robin Warner. See you.